Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about Wisconsin's wildlife. We do this every month, first Wednesday of the month, with Scott Craven, who is a professor at the UW-Madison and Extension in Wildlife Ecology. And Scott, it's a pleasure to have you here at the microphone.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's nice to be here. Always is, and especially in a day like this one. It seems more like April than
That's
January.
That's right. I looked back at a couple of January questions from a couple of years past, and we didn't talk about the kind of weather that we're seeing today.
No one could have expected this, even with some global warming scenarios.
And what does this kind of weather, what is the effect of it on, let's say, birds or on animals?
Well, I guess I'd have to say it's kind of a mixed blessing. As long as it holds like this, it's great news for virtually all wildlife. They have to expend less energy. Food supplies are not covered by ice and snow. But on the other hand, it seems to have accelerated a lot of activity among birds and perhaps some mammals. The same way, for example, as we were talking before the program, we've both got flowers like jonquils and things starting to poke up out of the ground on the south side of the house. So over the weekend, I looked out the window, and there in the backyard, and we have some prairie grass, was a rooster pheasant chasing a hen around the yard, fanning out his feathers and fanning his tail and so forth. I said, wow, that looks a lot like spring activity, and it's way too advanced for that, or way too early in the year for that kind of thing. So that, coupled with the fact that if things all of a sudden take a sudden nosedive and it gets cold and icy, there are birds in particular still around, things like great blue herons and birds that are dependent on open water or wetlands that are open in the southern part of the state that could be caught in a bad way if things turned around very quickly. So it's a bit of a mixed blessing all the way around, but I think from the standpoint of making life a little easier, not just for people but for many wildlife species, it's probably not a bad thing right now.
Okay. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about Wisconsin's wildlife, either our natives or those passing through, then you can call us in Madison at 263-1890, or it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. I know that there was a report in the newspaper about the snowy owl spotted on a crane in Madison. May have been one, may have been two. There was two sightings, but lots of people seeing this snowy owl. And this is kind of unusual, isn't it, to have this bird here?
Well, they're periodic visitors from the far north in Canada, usually when they move down to warmer climes to find food resources. It seems like if this is one bird or perhaps a couple birds, they may feel they've moved a little too far south given the weather conditions we've been having. But they turn up periodically, and they're usually a great curiosity when they do because they're a spectacular bird. And seeing one sitting on the end of some of these large construction cranes that have sprung up all around Madison is pretty spectacular. One of my colleagues sent me an email image of the bird sitting at the end of a crane, and it was perfectly framed with the Capitol in the background and the bird just below the Capitol dome. And it was way up there. I'm not sure maybe they feel are up out of harm's way in the hustle and bustle of humanity below, but it certainly doesn't look like a very good hunting perch.
Yeah, and I read that they don't seem to be afraid of the swinging motion of the arm of the crane either.
Maybe they just think it's a big windy branch.
All right, let's go to the phones, take some calls. We'll start off with Dean in Lomira. Hello, Dean. What can we do for you?
I haven't heard anything all in the last year about wild pigs in southwestern Wisconsin. I was just kind of wondering what the status was on them, and I'll listen to the radio.
All right. Thanks very much for your call.
Well, Dean, I haven't heard a whole lot either, and I think that's a reflection of the fact that that initial flurry of excitement just kind of died away. Wildlife issues have a way of attracting immediate attention. A rare bird like a snowy owl brings people out to see it, and then all of a sudden, after it's been sitting there for a month or 2 months, the interest kind of wanes, and I think that's what happened with the pig situation, in addition to the fact that I just don't think the pigs were as numerous or as widespread as perhaps some initial media accounts led hunters to believe. And people who thought they could simply tear over to Richland or Vernon County and find a willing landowner and go out and fill a whole pickup truck with wild pigs, it just wasn't going to happen. And therefore, interest, I think, has fizzled out.
And Dennis in Sun Prairie, what's on your mind today?
As a kid, it seemed like seeing a Canadian goose was a rare event, but there were many, many, many ducks around, and the situation seems to be reversed now. I'm wondering why.
Well, let's take the geese first. First of all, geese were fairly scarce into the 30s and 40s and 50s. There were virtually no resident geese left in Wisconsin, and the migrant flocks that we see in spring and fall that are associated with Hork and Marsh were greatly depleted. Then in 1964, I think it was, the resident birds, the subspecies of Canada geese known as giant Canada geese, were rediscovered. A population was still hanging on that wintered over in Rochester, Minnesota, and nested in southern Manitoba. And these birds were encouraged, moved around the countryside in a restoration effort that has proven to be unbelievably successful, probably way too successful, in that those birds have adapted just incredibly well to industrial sites, urban parks, and other environments that we as people have created, in addition to giving them the protection of urban and suburban areas. So the resident giant Canada goose flock all across the northern tier of states has just grown astronomically in the last 15 or 20 years. So those birds that were virtually absent at the time you're talking about as a child are now incredibly abundant. And superimposed on top of that, the migratory flocks associated with Hork and big refuges in Illinois have also grown greatly. So we have the migratory birds in much greater abundance, and the resident birds in tremendous abundance where there were virtually none previously. So that's the goose situation. Your observation is absolutely correct. There are far more of them, and they're far more widely distributed and far more tolerant of humans than a lot of people would have ever imagined. On the duck side, duck populations come and go, I think, to a certain extent with conditions on the breeding grounds, more so than geese. But duck populations have been doing pretty well. And I suspect that at this point, most of our common duck species are as numerous or more numerous than they've been in recent years or as they've been in recent years. But they're dispersed across lots of areas of suitable habitat and perhaps just not as visible as you may remember. And the geese may have simply overwhelmed them. You see the geese and kind of ignore the ducks, but they're still there. So that's the situation on the waterfowl front.
All right, Dennis, thank you very much for your call. Our guest is Scott Craven. He is a wildlife ecologist with UW-Madison and Extension. And our number in Madison is 263-1890. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free call. And, of course, the email address talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Jerry next in Racine. Hello, Jerry.
Hi. Hey, I really like your show. Thanks for letting me on. Mr. Craven could comment or inform us on what's the status of the presence or the alleged presence of mountain lions in Wisconsin.
You're getting them all today, Scott.
Well, the mountain lion situation crops up with incredible regularity, and how shall I summarize this? There are regular sightings, some of reasonable certainty due to the observer or the sign that's found, some of questionable authenticity, but there are enough sightings scattered around the state so that they're routinely tracked both by the DNR and a crew of students and a faculty member at UW-Stevens Point who are assembling this information. And I don't think anybody questions the notion that there are some, probably not a lot, but some mountain lions present in Wisconsin, virtually anywhere in the state. It's not necessarily only in the north or only in the southwest. Sightings come from all over the state, but the origin of the animals is still in question, and as far as I know, there's still no evidence in Wisconsin that they've been reproducing, and they're certainly not a remnant of the former population that disappeared, you know, a century or more ago. These are animals that have likely moved in from elsewhere or are residuals of escaped or released pets or captive animals. So they're around. I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility of someone seeing one at virtually any time in virtually any place.
Interesting. Well, thanks a lot.
Hi, Jerry. Thank you very much. We got an email earlier today from a woman in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, Walworth County, live in a heavily wooded rural area, and as we were about to let the dogs out around 9:30 at night, we noticed a furry little creature about the size of a chipmunk scurry up and down an oak tree. It had a light belly, looked like it had large eyes, and it would go quickly down the tree, grab a seed from a ground feeder, then quickly go back up the tree. I know this is not much to go on, but I was intrigued by this little animal and was wondering what it could be. Thank you so much for your help.
Well, actually, Diane has provided us with much more to go on than many observations.
That's true.
If we consider the habitat, heavily wooded, that matches with what I'm thinking about. Very furry, well, that matches well. Size of a chipmunk, that's pretty good. And big eyes, well, and grabbing a seed and running up the tree. So I think what she's seeing is a flying squirrel. Oh, and she mentioned a light belly, too, which also matches. The southern flying squirrel is about chipmunk size, very furry. A big, flat, furry, rudder-like tail, large eyes because they're nocturnal, so the time matches as well. So, in fact, if you dissect out all of Diane's comments, it matches perfectly with a southern flying squirrel in a large tree, going down to get a seed, and running back up the tree simply because they can't really fly. It could glide. So if she had, for example, a feeder mounted on a post nearer the house, she might see that animal glide from the tree to the feeder, and then glide off the feeder to the ground level, but they can't gain altitude. They can literally only come from a higher point to a lower point by gliding. So anyway, I think Diane's observation, and I'll lock in my answer on this, is southern flying squirrel.
All right, there you have it. Let's go to Jim next in Luck. And Jim, what's on your mind today?
I've done a lot of hiking in county forests this fall, and there's quite a few beaver houses that are just about in dry. You know, there's no water on them because it's been so dry here, and I'm assuming that's bad for beavers, that maybe predators can get them. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. If the beaver pond or stream or whatever dries up or goes low, then the beavers are more vulnerable to predator activity, although depending on where you are in the state, there aren't a whole lot of things that will prey on an adult beaver. That's a sizable animal. But I think if it gets to the point where the lodge is basically high and dry, and their food source and protection from weather and the elements and so forth is eliminated, the beavers will simply relocate it to where there is permanent water and then maybe re-inhabit the former location when water returns in the spring.
Jim, thanks very much for your call. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890 and toll-free at 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Scott Craven. And our next caller is Ron, and Ron is in the town of Dunn. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
Scott, first of all, I'd like to hear whether you have any new news on DNR philosophies related to the various deer herd management strategies. We hunt in 76M close to Madison on about 60 wooded acres, but we're surrounded literally by thousands of acres where either people trophy hunt or they don't allow hunting at all. And, you know, we've tried to adopt the philosophy of 2-for-1 or 3-for-1 or 4-for-1 for that matter, but we seem to be in the minority in the area where we hunt, and every year our take seems to be reducing. Is there any incentive that DNR is planning to encourage hunters to adopt the 2-for-1 or more for one philosophy?
Well, for listeners not familiar with what Ron is talking about, this battle cry kind of that we entered the deer season with was shoot two does or antlerless deer for every buck taken in the harvest. And that didn't necessarily mean that if you were lucky enough to shoot a buck that you had to rush out there and try and get two does as well, but that overall they were striving for an average in the harvest of two antlerless deer for every buck. And as it's something that an individual might use as a guiding principle, that's a good thing to work from. Not always the easiest thing to do, as the caller Ron points out, in an area where there is either surrounding refuge area where people simply don't allow hunting for whatever reason, safety concerns, disagreement with the philosophies of hunting, or what have you. That, of course, is part of a problem. Sometimes there are simply urban or suburban areas near a hunting ground where hunting is not possible because of firearms regulations. And then occasionally you run into a budding property where even deer hunters disagree on what they're going to do as far as a harvest strategy. And there are still some, apparently, who are taking only trophy or large bucks and maybe not killing as many antlerless deer as they should, according to the DNR. It's very difficult. I guess the basic question about what can be done about this, and I think, Ron, that in the long run, it's an educational process. I think the DNR has been actually fairly successful. There's certainly a ways to go, but fairly successful in convincing hunters in general that this was a worthwhile goal to try and attain of two does for every buck. And I heard people talking about that and thinking about it or assessing the success of their group toward that goal. So I think it's a slow process, but progress is being made. As far as the problems of being in an urbanized county like Dane or Unit 76M and running into the problems of no hunting or trophy hunting or whatever, that too, over the long haul, I think necessitates people reaching out to neighbors or friends who perhaps are not allowing hunting and simply talking to them about the impacts of those deer on the land the people may control in terms of plant diversity, or you know, maybe they're interested in growing some evergreen trees or fruit trees or something else and simply don't realize the tremendous impact that a large deer herd can have on that kind of an enterprise, or the impact the deer that they may be protecting for whatever reason may be having on an adjoining farmer's property. So it's all a very slow process of people working with people and the DNR working with people to try and get these messages across and eventually be adopted. But progress does seem to be in the works, but I fully recognize there are certainly pockets of resistance or individuals who are especially difficult to reach or make contact with or may not even live in the state where you have a problem. So that, I guess, is my take on the situation.
Thank you much.
All right, Ron, thank you very much. Our guest is Scott Craven. He is a professor of wildlife ecology at UW Madison and Extension. I'm Jim Packard. Our phone producer today is Keisha Mabra, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Last call reminded me that the Executive Council of the Conservation Congress has a meeting on Friday in Stevens Point and is going to take up the subject of baiting and feeding once again. And Scott, you've indicated that it's another hornet's nest.
Well, it is a hornet's nest, Jim, and it's one that I think we could probably talk about for hours and get lots of feedback on.
But since we have a short program.
But we have a short program, so I'll try and give you the Reader's Digest version. The concern has been raised, I think, recently. It's always been a concern, but I think two things happened in the past few weeks that probably threw some oil on the fire here. One was the publication of research findings that indicated that chronic wasting disease could be transmitted by saliva, nose-to-nose contact of deer, or deer slobbering on one another, the kind of thing that could be envisioned at a pile of food.
Mm-hmm.
That was one issue, and that confirmed some, I think, a strong feeling on many people's part that had been around for a long time. Number two, the chief warden, the conservation warden for the DNR, came out with his summary of violations over the course of the hunting season, and there were a very large number and an increased number of violations associated with baiting and how it was conducted. And I think those things have combined along with general unrest in some parts of the hunting community about the impacts that widespread use of bait during the hunting season is having on deer movements and perhaps the way non-hunters view hunters' participation in deer hunting and lots of other considerations. So bottom line is there's reconsideration of whether these two practices, which are similar but distinct in many ways, the baiting of deer, which is associated with the hunting season to get deer in a particular spot where a hunter has clear access to them for harvest purposes versus feeding, which is a more widespread tactic used year-round by many people who have no interest in deer hunting but are simply interested in either their perception that they're helping the deer herd Or perhaps they simply want the deer close in, or both, where they can see and observe them and take pictures and so forth. So we have not heard the last on this by any means. It's very divisive, even within the hunting community, which is, I think, probably the worst part of it as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think that, given all the other things deer hunting and deer hunters face in the state right now, that issues that really divide them intensely like this one does is not a good thing, regardless of the outcome of the discussions.
And the end of the deer hunt will be the late archery deer season closing this weekend.
Yes, on Sunday the 7th, the late archery season closes. It's not completely the end, because within the chronic wasting disease management areas, people can still hunt under landowner permits until, I think, the end of March. Although that's a relatively, in the bigger scheme of Wisconsin deer hunting, that's a rather minor part of it. But yes, the season will officially end on Sunday the 7th, and I'm told that by probably mid-January we'll have the detailed numbers on what the harvest was for all of the combined hunting opportunities dating back to last September.
Scott, let's go back to the phones to Barb in South Range. Barb, what can we do for you today?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was reading an article that was kind of buried in the Superior Daily Telegram last night that talked about the fact that the federal government had approved the killing of muted swans in Wisconsin. And the reason given was they're not a Wisconsin natural species, and that they wanted to kill the muted swans to make room for what they considered the natural birds of the state of Wisconsin. I find this appalling, and I didn't know anything about it until reading this article last night. So if your guest could comment on that, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, Barb.
Well, Jim, the issue at hand is that there has been a court ruling recently that cleared the way for mute swan control, which is nothing new. All the court ruling did was really end a hiatus in mute swan control that has been ongoing for many years. In Wisconsin, I think, since about 97, and in states to the east, well before that. Mute swans are one of three swans people could see or encounter in the state. By far the most numerous are the tundra swans, formerly known as whistling swans, that migrate through the state in spring and fall. These are the ones you hear the large vocal flocks of, or see them scattered around flooded crop fields. So those birds nest way to the north of us, migrate through Wisconsin, winter on the east coast. And then the trumpeter swan, which is the native swan to this area, which the DNR has been working hard and very successfully to restore through the program of bringing eggs down from Alaska, hatching them, and essentially restoring individual pairs or populations of trumpeter swans in areas throughout the state. And then the mute swan, which is a Eurasian bird, an exotic bird, was brought to the country, again, by human activity or human introduction, as kind of the park or zoo or estate swan that we think about when we think back to earlier times in the country. And this was something people did in terms of needing a pair of swans outside the moat of their castle or whatnot for whatever purpose. However, it's been known for a long time that mute swans, A, they are an exotic species, but whether that's enough to condemn them into control is arguable, and obviously our caller here, Barb, feels it's not, as do other people. But besides the fact that they're simply an exotic species, there have been lots of studies that have demonstrated they have a tremendous capability to be destructive of wetland environments used by other waterfowl, including native swans. That's been a bit more of a problem to the east in places like Maryland and whatnot, where there are many more of them, and they've been very destructive. They're also very aggressive toward other waterfowl. In fact, swan decoys are sometimes used as a scare tactic to place a swan decoy on, say, a golf course pond, with the idea that it will keep geese and ducks and so forth out of the pond. So obviously the geese and ducks know that they're fairly aggressive, and they can be aggressive to people too. So anyway, there are a variety of reasons, ecological, social, and simply biological in terms of their exotic species nature, that led to the start of mute swan control in the east, and then it's moved west. And as I said, Wisconsin's been controlling them for a number of years, And there have been several hundred, quite a few hundred actually, if you look at the statistics that have come out recently, that have been removed from the population in Wisconsin. One population that was quite visible for many years was up in Ashland around the Fish Creek Slough and so forth along the shores, southern shores of Shawamigan Bay. That population has been greatly reduced. So the bottom line is that numbers in Wisconsin right now seem to be, from what I've seen, in spite of the fact that some birds may migrate over from Michigan at times of the year and so forth, perhaps 150, 200 breeding birds, perhaps less. So there's an opportunity here to get on top of population control, which I said they've been doing for a long time, but had to stop when there was an interpretation of the Migratory Bird Treaty. And the interpretation was that mute swans were protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty. It's since been revised and reinterpreted by the courts, which is the ruling she's referring to, that mute swans are in fact not protected. And that then clears the way for states to reinstate, reinstate being the key thing. This is right. Not a new thing. It's been going on for a long time to simply reinstate their control activities to try and keep a lid on the mute swan population because of their destructive tendencies. Now, there are some exceptions. There's a small pocket of these birds, in fact, most of the population that still exists, in a couple townships in Racine County where they've essentially sought an exemption from control, and I think there's kind of a hands-off policy on that remnant population. But as long as they could be contained, you know, it's not probably not that big a deal. It's kind of like other exotics, like purple loosestrife that we've heard so much about. You know, if you really like the appearance of purple loosestrife and could keep it in a pot on your patio, well, it probably isn't a huge deal. But you can't because it spreads and it gets into native wetlands and it's incredibly destructive and so forth. So as a result, there's no choice but to try and eliminate it. The same kind of logic is being used on the mute swans.
You heard a news account earlier this morning which indicated that there maybe an opportunity for the public to become involved in the harvest of mute swans. And well, I think you wanted to knock that story down.
The impression that I got from what I heard on the radio was that this was being promoted. Well, there may be a hunting opportunity for mute swans. And to me, this was analogous to the fracas we had a year or two ago when we came out with this. Oh, there's going to be a hunting season on feral cats. There was no such proposal. It was simply an attempt there to provide some protection for landowners who might have been controlling feral cats for whatever reason. Nobody was really interested in hunting cats. I don't think anybody's really interested in hunting mute swans. With less than 150 of them, what kind of a hunt is that going to provide? This is simply the sanctioning of the DNR's control, which I think may be construed as perhaps hunting opportunity, which it's not. Now, some swans are hunted. The tundra swans that we see flying overhead mm-hmm. are hunted on the East Coast, vigorously hunted on the East Coast, but not here. They're protected here in Wisconsin. So there's a fair bit of opportunity for confusion here, but I don't think there's much opportunity or desire for sport hunting of mute swans or any other swan in Wisconsin.
Scott Craven, our guest, as we talk about Wisconsin's wildlife. It's an abbreviated program today. It's not the usual hour and a half. It's going to be the hour because at noon we have the inauguration ceremonies live from the state capitol for Governor Jim Doyle and the other state constitutional officers who were elected in November. So that'll be a long live from the state capitol at noon. But right now we continue to talk and take calls, and Matt is next in Stevens Point. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question regards landings and wood turtles.
Mm-hmm.
It is my understanding that they are on the endangered and protected list in Wisconsin.
They are protected, yes.
There are local construction practices in the area, and from Stevens Point to Wausau, and there are many turtle zones in the crossing of where they're doing work. And uh-huh. after November 1st, the DNR basically gives permission to go into those turtle crossing areas because these turtles go into hibernation. The ground should be frozen enough. And so my concern was, one question, how far do they burrow? How far do they, you know, hibernate into the ground? I know they go into wetland areas, ponds, banks, stream banks, you know, natural wetland areas. And so how far do they burrow into the ground? And then what... I know it's temperature involved, but how long do the temperatures have to be at a certain like warm level, because these warm temperatures, it's going to be 45 tomorrow. And
I mean, is it possible that they may become active again?
Yeah, would they come out and therefore...
And therefore be vulnerable because it's after November 1st?
Right.
Is that your basic concern?
Yeah.
In other words, an aberrant year like this, all of a sudden a protection that was put in place to benefit the turtles because of strange weather that keeps them active actually causes a problem.
Yes, that was my concern.
Well, part of your question I can't answer, because I think the type of substrate that they're in and how cold it is and whether the pond's freezing solid will dictate a lot about, you know, how much they try and dig in or get out of harm's way. In the case of box turtles, which hibernate high and dry in sandy soil, they can dig down, you know, 30 inches or 3 feet or more. And I think they can go up or down in the sand or soil column depending on frost penetration. So if frost reached them, for example, I think they'd go deeper. Here we have a year where there's very little ice, if any, and very little frost penetration so far. So I suspect that there's no incentive for these animals to try and go deeper at this point. Whether or not they might become active if things really got warm here, well, I suppose it's possible. So I guess the bottom line, Matt, I can't say for sure, but there may be some herpetologists within the DNR who are thinking about this, people like Bob Hay, who could respond or be contacted, that, yeah, this could be one of those things that, as we started the program talking about the impacts of prolonged warm weather on wildlife activity, it is possible that some of these things could become active or put themselves in a danger zone that would be otherwise out of limits on a normal year. That's the long and short of it.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Matt. Thank you very much for your call. And if you'd like to join in, there is a line opening up. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Elsewhere, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Scott Craven. And our next caller is going to be Nancy in Colfax. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and I can take my answer off the air.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen two robins today, this morning, in my oak tree, and we have a large lot, two lots from the Red Cedar River.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if the robins returned very early, because I've never seen any in January, or if they stayed all winter. Thank you.
I'm guessing, Nancy, these are probably robins that never left. There are areas around the state that are notorious for harboring robins most of the winter, even in what we might perceive as a normal winter. For example, around the springs on Lake Winger in the University Arboretum, there are commonly robins there all winter. There are some areas around La Crosse where robins are reported most winters. And since you mentioned you weren't too far from the river, I suspect that they're actually along that river corridor where there's open water and brushy shelter and so forth. So this is just guesswork. I'm thinking those are robins that have never left rather than robins that have returned, so that you can rush out and say, ah, spring has sprung, the robins have returned. I think they probably haven't left. Whether they will or not will depend on what happens with the weather. And if you want to do something for them, you know, then there are some feeds available that have chopped fruit and that kind of thing that may be beneficial.
If you'd like to hear more about that, we did a program on Monday, New Year's Day, with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, in which the topic of the robin population in Wisconsin was pretty thoroughly discussed. And
Did my assessment jibe with theirs?
It did.
Okay, good.
Surprisingly, Scott. Came out the same. All right, Dennis is next in Janesville. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Back in early December, I was traveling on Interstate 43 near Mequonago, and this pure white bird kind of caught my attention over on the south side of the highway there. And as I got closer, it landed in a tree, and it looked, I mean, just because of the way it landed and the wing structure, and I could kind of see its head, and it really looked like it was like a pure white hawk. And was I seeing things, or was it a different type of bird? Is there such thing as like an all-white hawk?
Well, there aren't that many large birds that are snow white, completely white, especially that would perch in a tree. So we've had reports over the years of albinos of various types of hawks that could be what you're seeing. And when such an albino is seen, it's usually conspicuous enough, especially now with no snow, that other people will report it. So it's possible that if you check in with your local DNR office or a nature center down in that neck of the woods, that they may have other sightings of this bird that would confirm what it is. But first guess is, yes, there are white raptors, like gear falcons and so forth, but those are far north birds. It would be far more likely that if it was a hawk, that it was an albino of a common species rather than a very rare bird.
Right.
Okay, Dennis, thank you very much for your observation and question. And Doug is next in Glen Beulah. Hi, Glenn.
I'm sorry, Doug.
Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about something I saw in the woods the other day. I was on New Year's Day walking through the woods with my family, and I saw a mouse perched in a tree, and a piece of brush, and I realized that it was actually impaled. Mm-hmm. I think I know one bird that does this. The question I have is there more than one bird that does this sort of thing?
Well, is the bird you're thinking of a shrike?
Yes.
Or butcher bird, as it's sometimes called?
Yeah.
Well, that's the common one that might impale something like that. But there may be others. I wonder if a kestrel might do that, or a sparrowhawk or kestrel, or perhaps some other type of raptors. Even crows will occasionally snatch something that they've found dead, maybe not kill it, but find it dead and stash a piece of a small mammal, chipmunk or whatnot, in a bird bath or some other site. So the first thing that comes to mind when you find one literally impaled, some type of prey item, is the work of a shrike, but there may be a couple others that figured that out.
The shrike. I've seen a lot of birds around here, but never seen a shrike.
They're not common by any means, but you do see them occasionally.
Okay, well, thanks for the info.
All right, Doug, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate your input. And let's go to Mary Ann in Eau Claire next. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi. I have a little cold, so I sound terrible. But I wondered whether you know anything, I'm sure you do, about the otters. I live on, actually, I don't live in Eau Claire. I live in Ashland on Lake Superior.
Uh-huh.
And we have a boathouse. And we've had it forever. And we never had this problem until the last few years. And it's right in the middle between the two boats, you know, that we placed up. And it's just really bad.
These are otter droppings that they're leaving
behind? No, they're actually the damn otters.
They've taken over the boathouse?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you believe it? And we've tried everything like...
Those damn otters.
Do you have any advice how to...
So you actually can go down to the boathouse and there sitting on your docking between your boats is an otter or several otters.
Yeah, well, you see them scampering, but they've left a mess.
Yeah, they certainly will leave a mess. I certainly think as you approach them, they'll leave. They do that.
Yeah, but you can't walk on the walkway.
Because of all the
feces
they've left behind. Well, that part of it is a fairly common problem. Even in the boathouse where I'm working part-time now up at our university station on Lake Tomahawk, when the otters are going through... In the warm season, they'll commonly leave a big pile of remains right on the dock.
Yeah.
And usually you can tell not many animals would do that, but otter poop usually has a variety of things like crayfish shells and things like that that make it easy to identify.
Yeah.
Well, so I assume that the boathouse now is frozen in.
Well, I assume it is, yeah. You know, the boats are hoisted. And all that.
So you're not too worried about it this time of year, but this also happens during the warm season?
Oh, I know, and you know.
Well, that was a question. Is that the problem, that it's really during the warm season when you're using the boathouse?
Well, they don't hibernate
no.
or anything.
No, they're active all year.
Well, I haven't been in it now since we put everything, you know, to sleep, the boats, and but...
It's all summer
it goes on.
Is this a very large boathouse?
Well, yeah, it has, you know, two big boats in it.
Okay. Well, I'm just thinking that this time of year, basically the problem is you've got an open space between the boathouse itself and the frozen ice surface.
Uh-huh.
And that could be easily screened off.
Yeah, we have a chain under where the doors go, you know, go down
right.
or up to leave the boats out. And... It's like, but it isn't like a hard you know, chain or a hard screen. It's just a, well, we've never had that problem before.
Well, I think that really if you want to stop the problem, especially when you're not using the boathouse, then screening off that open area, much as you would treat the boathouse as if it were a deck attached to somebody's home that had raccoons or some other animal living under the deck, then you screen off that opening and prevent them from having access. As far as during the warmer season when you wouldn't want the screening there, I think enough activity will discourage the otters. And if it didn't, then there are probably some repellents. Spray repellents, things that are used, for example, like chaperone dog or cat repellent to keep pets away from shrubbery, from urinating on shrubbery, that spraying that around liberally might discourage them. Most mammals don't like moth flakes. Little bags of moth flakes in, say, a piece of nylon stocking, thumb-tacked along the edges of the boat slips, I think would also discourage them. So I think you should do what you need to do for this winter, but come spring, call me at my office, and we'll run through the litany of things you can try to discourage them.
Oh, great. What is your phone number?
You can call me at my office in Madison, which is 263-6325.
Okay.
Area 608.
Thank you.
All right, Mary Ann, good luck to you. It's an unusual occurrence it happens more frequently than I imagine.
I hear problems about people complaining that otters defecate on their boathouse docks or piers or whatever periodically, but, you know, the water's right there, so with a bucket and slosh, that's the end of it. Having them actually sitting there when you open the boathouse is a little more disconcerting.
Hi, what's for lunch? Our guest is Scott Craven. We'll be back in just a moment to take more of your calls here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller today, talking about Wisconsin's wildlife with Professor Scott Craven, a wildlife ecologist with UW-Madison and University Extension. One of the things I noticed from Adrian Weidevin, the DNR's wolf expert at Park Falls, was an increase in the number of wolves that were killed during the 2006 gun deer season, quite a jump from the one wolf killed in 2005 and the two in 2006. I should say 2004 and 2005. What was the number during the 2006 gun deer season?
It was nine, which is up from up quite a bit, as you said, from only, I think it was a single wolf killed in 2004, a couple the year before. Previous high was in 2002 when I think there were five. But all of a sudden, nine, and the nine represent what were actually found or that people turned in. I think four of the nine had radio transmitters on,
mm-hmm.
And as Adrian has pointed out, with only about 10% of the estimated population actually radio collared, if you do a little bit of math and some ratios, the likelihood is quite good that there were quite a few more wolves killed than the nine that were actually found or reported, which is a little disturbing considering that we're looking at a population estimate of 500, give or take, during the winter. So we're talking about, you know, a significant 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% of the population being killed just during that gun deer season, which is very disturbing, considering the fact that the fines are incredibly steep, both at the federal and state level, for illegally and knowingly killing a wolf. Either there's a combination of some mistakes here, which is one issue, but there's also apparently some malicious killing of these animals, perhaps because of the ill will generated by concern over depredations on dogs, livestock, or just disagreement over the way the state's handling wolf management. So, one way or the other, it was a disturbing and significant upturn in the number of wolves killed during the deer season.
All right, let's take a couple more calls before we go off to the state capitol for the inaugural ceremonies. Sarah is next in Neshkoro. Hello, Sarah. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've been thinking about birds, and since our winter is so warm, I wanted to tell you I saw what I think was either a great horned or a barn owl. I can't tell the difference. And also have many bluebirds at our bird bath this winter. And where we live, it's very transition from sort of the prairie to the North Woods.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of open areas. And it was real exciting to see that owl this morning right about dawn.
Well, owls are always spectacular, as the snowy owl we were talking about a little earlier. It could have been a great horned or a barred owl. They're both resident birds. They're both large. A great horn may be a little larger. If you see it again, what to look for, I think, are the distinctive ear tufts on the great horned owl, giving it its name, or on the barred owl, the kind of a more distinctive facial disc and a breast that's distinctively streaked vertically with dark and light. And if you hear them call, they're very different. The great horned owl is the deep hooting sound that people hear at night, and the barred owl has that distinctive kind of a hoo, characterized as who cooks for you, who cooks for you all, which is easily duplicated, but I won't do that today for fear of scaring off our listening audience. But in any event, you could have seen either one, and the bluebird situation is kind of like the robin situation we were discussing a little earlier. They, too, have found conditions to be a lot more benign and benevolent this year than a normal Wisconsin winter. If there are any more normal Wisconsin winters.
Yeah, well, it's not the winters of our childhood, that's for sure. Well, it's been exciting because we've seen upwards of anywhere from 5 to 8 or 9 bluebirds at a time around the bird bath. So
it's pretty neat.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, really neat.
Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Stan in Monroe County. Stan, what's in your mind today?
Randy Travis has a song. He talks about the call of the whippoorwill. I haven't heard a whippoorwill for several years. What happened to them?
The whippoorwills have experienced some population declines. They winter way down into South and Central America and have had some declining populations. They are not as common in western and southwestern Wisconsin in the wooded area and the driftless area as they once were. If you want to check that out a little bit and have access to a computer, we talked about a website on the last program called eBird, which you can get on to fairly easily. That's promoted by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. And then once you're on eBird, you can go to North American Birds, which is a reference library on all birds, and simply click on or type in whippoorwills, and you'll see the distribution map and the population trends for whippoorwills and can confirm what's going on for your own area.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And then you can get the Wisconsin Bird Breeding Atlas from the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and look at the statewide distribution of whippoorwills as well. So we'll have it covered. Stan, thank you so much. We did have a caller about fish kill with many, many fish coming up on Lake Winnebago. Yeah. Any ideas on that?
I saw something about that, and I've not had a chance to. I just saw it this morning, haven't had a chance to check it out, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's got something to do with weather conditions and either oxygen depletion or some type of winter kill-related phenomenon.
And to Kate in New London next. Hello, Kate.
Hello. Thank you. Question for you. My mother also lives in the area, and she told me about a coyote that she has seen around her house. She lives out in the country, wooded area, and there's kind of an abandoned garage a little ways from her house, and she has seen this coyote. The other day, she was able to get out binoculars to take kind of a good look at it, just kind of because she was curious, and she could see that he had a lot of patches of hair missing, and he was really scratching a lot, and kind of skin and bones kind of thing. And I guess I kind of have a twofold question. One, she feels sorry for the little thing and is kind of putting some meat out just to see if it can help, you know, get strength back. Is that an okay thing? Is that a good idea? And secondly, she has a dog that when he's outside, he is supervised, but he's not necessarily in a leash because she likes to let him run around and get some exercise and things. She's scared to kind of let him run around for fear of the coyote being around and, you know, the dog getting hurt or getting sick from the coyote. I guess I'm just kind of curious as to your opinion on all that.
Well, a hairless or partially hairless coyote could be a victim of mange or a couple of other skin conditions that cause the hair to fall out. That's not at all uncommon, and occasionally you see them with virtually. I had someone, a caller from a program years ago, sent us a snapshot of a coyote kind of outlined against the edge of a cornfield in the summer, and it was completely naked. I mean, absolutely, there was no hair on at all. It was a strange-looking creature. And I can understand your mother's empathy toward the animal, but I don't necessarily think putting food out is going to solve anything and could, if she's worried about the dog, make the problem a whole lot worse by habituating the coyote to humans and the household and so forth. So I understand the intention, but I don't think that's a good idea. It's ill-advised. As far as any problem posed to the dog, members of the dog family do compete with each other, and I think especially if the animal, the coyote, is debilitated in any way and the dog approached it too closely, you know, maybe they could get into it. But as far as the possibility that anything the coyote has might be transmissible to the dog or what to do about that, I think that's a question she should pose to her local vet.
Kate, thank you very much for your call. I'm sorry that we won't be able to get to more calls. I know that the DNR is increasing the number of spring turkey hunting permits for the 2007 hunt to 206,415. That's up about 5,200 permits over last year.
It's a great situation. I mean, the turkeys continue to be an unbelievable success story. Considering there were no turkeys as recently as 1976, 30-some years ago, now the population's estimated around 400,000. The harvest was about 46,000. I just happened to be browsing through the Wild Turkey Federation magazine last night, and I think that puts Wisconsin from no turkeys not that long ago to a harvest that's, I think, in the top three nationally as far as states are concerned. It's a pretty amazing deal, and more permits means more people get a chance to go out there and hunt.
So that would indicate that if you've got 206,000 and you've got 46,000 turkeys last year, it's about one in four gets a permit. And on that note, I have to stop because we're out of time.
So
Scott,
be it.
Thank you very much for being here. We'll look forward to you the first Wednesday of next month here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.